Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. Well, this morning we'll be talking about the current crisis, not so current perhaps, roiling America's financial system. And it's certainly something that has been in the news on a regular basis, beginning with the so-called subprime mortgage crisis and what that has meant for some individuals across the country. Certainly people in record numbers have ended up defaulting on their mortgages. That has also affected many financial institutions, some of the country's biggest banks and investment firms. And for all concerned, one result has been that borrowing money has become much more difficult. Another, perhaps, is that people's confidence in the financial system in this country has been shaken. So this morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about what went wrong and ask this question. Has this all ultimately been a regulatory failure? And should there be some changes in the regulations that affect banks and big investment firms? Our guest for the program in this hour is Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And we'll talk about it. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their questions and comments brief just so we can keep moving along. But anybody who is listening is welcome to call and join in the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me here, David.
Before talking a little bit about how we got to this point, and I think it would be good for us to do that because I think with as much coverage as the story has gotten, I think there are still people who aren't quite sure what it is that happened. Before doing that, though, let me, as a large question to start out with, ask, really, is this a regulatory failure? Is that what happened here?
No, it's not a regulatory failure. It's more of a failure of the markets and people anticipating prices on housing or any asset, in this case it was housing, to continue to appreciate at the levels that have been appreciating over the past few years and extrapolating that into the future. And that was unrealistic. And when it stopped appreciating, then suddenly the music stopped and prices started going down and people got caught holding the bag at that particular point.
So as far as you're concerned, the big issue here was the bubble, the unrealistic inflation, or maybe I shouldn't use the word inflation, unrealistic growth in the values that had been put on real estate.
Well, housing prices did increase because they had been a very steady source of increase in investment value. If you go back to as far as the 1960s, housing prices on a nominal basis have increased almost every year since that time period. So as a result of that dependable increase, people started relying on housing as a very stable form of investment. And as we witnessed the dot-com collapse in the stock market in the late 1990s, and stock market problems in the early 2000s, people were drawn both as investments for investment purposes as well for building home equity into buying a house. In addition, financial markets came up with some nice innovations to help people qualify for more and more expensive homes that might not otherwise be doing that. For example, something that in retrospect sounds extremely dangerous, an interest-only loan, mm-hmm. that you take out a mortgage and all you do is pay interest for a few years, and then after that your payments increase significantly and then you start paying down the value of the loan. That's very risky. People were not doing that historically, but as housing prices were going up and people thought that housing prices would continue to go at a 10 or 15% rate per year, it might make sense to do something like that as long as prices kept increasing on homes. Then the investment market was enamored by investing in homes because they were turned out to be a very appropriate investment. Wall Street responded by coming up with something that's called collateralized debt obligations, which were invested in mortgages, including subprime mortgages. And they got more and more sophisticated in how they packaged those and sold them to investors, such as pension funds or municipalities or international investors that looked at this as a stable form of investment because the collateral was so good. The collateral would be the real estate. As soon as housing prices started leveling off and then falling, the collateral wasn't as good, and these investors started losing money or fearing they were losing money before they even lost money, and they stopped investing in them. That market in essence, locked up, and institutions that were holding those, whether they were banks or pension funds or individual investors, found they couldn't sell those particular investments anymore, and that led to a panic among many investors and many financial institutions. Hmm. So it was more investment behavior and a tendency to think that what's happened in the past is going to continue rather than regulation being the root cause of this problem.
Yeah. Let's talk about what happened with the problems that happened with lending, with mortgage lending. Because as you said, there were people who were offering and people who were taking advantage of loans that in the past just wouldn't have been offered. Interest-only loans. Then perhaps there were people who were being offered adjustable rate loans where you initially got a favorable interest rate that might go for a year or two, and then suddenly you might find yourself paying much more. Now, if you were thinking maybe you'd only be in that house for a year or two, or that you could flip it and make some money, well, maybe that would be okay. But if you thought that you were going to be in there for the long term, well, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea. But apparently there were people who were attracted by the fact that this was a really good rate right up front. And we do now know that there were people who were making loans, signing people up for mortgages, when those individuals really didn't qualify for the loan. And in some cases, it's pretty clear that there was actually fraud going on. That there was no way that some of these people were qualified for those loans, but somebody wrote the loan anyway. And then those people got into trouble because for one reason or another, they couldn't make their payments. They had to walk away from the property. It was secured by the property, and I guess that's okay if the property maintains its value, but then we had this problem with the bursting bubble, as you suggest. And so people then were ending up holding property that wasn't worth what the loan was for. So having said all that, who is it that's responsible for regulating mortgage lenders? And is there a problem here of oversight? Should there in fact have been someone looking over the shoulder of some of these lenders who were writing these subprime loans and saying to them, well, we won't let you do this because this person's credit is not good and the risk here is too great?
There are a variety of sources that are looking at that right now, some at the state level, some at the federal level. If anything, it's a matter of a patchwork of regulations relating to this. But the mortgage originator was not bearing the risk, and as long as they were able to find a willing investor to take the packages of mortgages, they made money by originating it. They weren't concerned about whether the person could make their loan. I think perhaps they should have out of a humanitarian standpoint, but they were getting paid to issue loans, and they could find investors at least up through 2006 to early 2007 that would invest in those properties, even though the loan were not verified. In fact, that's one of the things about a subprime loan is that the income statement supporting the mortgage is not being checked, and they also don't check the credit ratings as much as they would on the ones that would qualify for the general packages where the government guaranteed by a government agency.
Yeah. Is there some fault here to be laid at the door of the credit rating agencies? Is it an issue that they weren't doing due diligence in reporting back to lenders what these people credit were? Or was it the lenders weren't even bothering to check the people's credit?
These are complex investment instruments, and they were brand new. And the rating agencies made some mistakes in assuming, for example, what the default rates would be on these new loans. They relied on some information early on that seemed to indicate that the default rate on interest-only loans or adjustable rate mortgages or mortgages in which people were taking out 100% of the loan rather than only 90% as they would on a conventional mortgage were relatively close. Well, they aren't. If people do not have equity in their home, then they're much more likely to default when the value of the home goes down than they would be if they have a significant ownership stake in there. So there were errors made in the models, and those models led to giving very high ratings for the credit. Therefore, investors came in, both domestic and internationally, to invest in these markets, thinking that these were very secure investments, and they weren't. So the rating agencies certainly would do it differently if they had that now, but again, it was something new. They weren't quite sure what to do with them, and the ratings they gave were a little bit more or were more optimistic than they should have been. And some people are blaming the rating agencies for the errors associated with this one. But The rating agencies have also corrected relatively quickly by now recognizing this, and if anything, they're probably rating more stringently than they should be because they don't want to make that mistake again. So things are tend to be self-correcting.
Yeah.
When you make a mistake, you learn a lesson and you don't make the same mistake again.
For those people who were writing these subprime loans, do you think, and this may be sort of outside of your area, I just wonder whether you think, in fact, we're going to start to see some people charged with crimes and some prosecutions for essentially, I suppose it would be for fraud at the very or not doing their due diligence at the very least.
Well, there could be cases of fraud in it on a lot of levels. For example, in some people who were taking out the mortgages indicated they were going to be living in these houses when they intended to, as you said, flip them. They had mortgages on dozens of homes in the area, and they simply were going to flip them over before. So those were much more susceptible to default because the people were never intending to even be there, but they were indicating it was their primary residence. Mm-hmm. Some of the mortgage lenders were also not doing due diligence, not checking up on facts as they should be, or indicating they had verified things when they actually hadn't. And there could be some cases. I'd expect civil litigation would take place on there, but there might be some cases of criminal as well. The laws have to be tested in this area. We haven't had this problem before, so it's very hard to say how it will develop out. But I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a lot of litigation against people who made some money on this particular area at the expense of people who defaulted on their homes.
Hmm. It was common practice, I think, and it had been for some time, for mortgage lenders, whoever writes that mortgage the first time, most of those mortgages are not held by the institution that originates the loan. They, I think, and you can tell me what the ratio is, that most of those go on to the secondary market. And in fact, it's possible that a mortgage could change hands a couple of times before that mortgage was finally paid off. And that part of the problem here is that then these large institutions were packaging large numbers of these subprime loans and then creating new kinds of investment instruments based on those, and that the whole thing fell apart because the asset essentially that had the value that was backing them up was overvalued. And if people started walking away from their homes and the asset securing it wasn't worth, wasn't worth the piece of paper, well, then you got yourself a problem. Does this do anything to the secondary mortgage market now? Will lending institutions now tend more to hold more mortgages? Will it be more difficult for them to sell them? Will others just not want to come along and pick up those mortgages for fear that somehow that deal will turn sour?
Well, we're in a very different world than we were in back in the 1980s when we'd go to our local savings and loan, take out a mortgage, and that savings and loan would hold that investment, and we would make payments to them, and they were entirely mm-hmm. responsible. Well, the savings and loans ran into trouble, and as a result, we're lending less. The markets were transformed in order to provide lending which wouldn't have otherwise existed because the savings and loans pulled back from this area. And these were the mortgage pools, the mortgage-backed securities, or now the collateralized debt obligations, which all transfer the risk from the originator of the mortgage to the investment market. And that's been going on for a long time. In fact, most mortgages are handled that way. I don't know the exact percentages, but most mortgages are being held by an investor separately from it. Mm-hmm. That creates something we call moral hazard, because suddenly the person who is originating the loan doesn't care about it being paid back. They only care about it being issued. And if they make money every time it's refinanced, then they would love to issue a loan, that an adjustable rate mortgage that has to be reissued in a few years as another adjustable rate mortgage at a higher level, because that's when they would make their money. Now, the investors certainly have wised up on this now and have become much less willing, demanding a much higher interest rate that they would get for the risks of insuring mortgages. And that's making it more difficult for people to get financing for homes. Even people who would normally qualify very easily, they're either having to pay higher interest rates or not eligible for a loan, or it's getting much more difficult. And that's affecting the housing market as well, because if qualified lenders, buyers can't get into the financing they need, then they simply can't buy the homes, and home prices will not recover as quickly. So that is a problem, but that's being done now by the investors that are demanding a higher return on their investments because they now realize that mortgages are more risky than they thought.
Yeah. Just one other quick question, and then we'll go on to some callers here. For these loans, these subprime loans, were these borrowers not required to have mortgage insurance?
Okay. The borrowers would be required to. They would either qualify for a standard mortgage, which requires them to have a certain amount of a down payment and have certain income standards so that the mortgage payments are no more than a certain percent of their annual income mm-hmm. and that they meet certain standards. But as housing prices rose, fewer people qualified for those, and therefore mortgages that would be subprime, which would not meet these conventional calculations, appeared in order to allow people to continue to participate in the housing market, an inflated value or a higher-priced housing market, allow them to still get in there. So in some ways, it's helping individuals, but it led to problems if people did get overextended where they couldn't make the additional payments.
Mm. Well, we have several callers here. We'll talk with them. Let me again introduce our guest, Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois. We're talking about recent concerns about the strength of the financial markets here in the United States and questions that have been raised about regulatory issues. And now certainly in Washington, D.C., in the Congress and in the Treasury, they're talking about making some changes the regulatory bodies, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start out here with a caller in Belgium, the town, not that far from here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have, and this doesn't seem logical to me, these choices that were made at a very high level in each and every bank and each and every corporation that's running these, that people at very high levels said, okay, we can do this kind of business. We want to do this kind of business. This makes sense for our business plan. Made these choices to go in this direction. Then the choices are wrong. And then when things go wrong, they are not punished in any way, but they're given a golden parachute to be getting many millions of dollars and sent along their way to go find another bank or corporation to pull some strange stunts there at. Where is the liability for these people?
I certainly agree with you that it seems incredible that somebody who would orchestrate a bank's forays into the complex mortgage industry market and causing the banks to lose billions of dollars would be rewarded, in essence, when they're terminated with a golden parachute that provides them with millions or tens of millions of dollars in severance pay. That certainly doesn't seem fair to me. The major problem that I would see would be the boards of directors who are responsible to the shareholders are setting up an incentive system for their managers that are rewarding them for taking risk. And then when the risks turn sour, then there's no punishment associated with that one. So of course, the managers will take additional excessive risk because they would win in the case of the gains occurring. As long as the housing market continued to boom, they were doing fine. And then when things go sour, they still have this protection of golden parachute they leave with the company. So I believe we need to get a better incentive system so that the individuals who are making the decisions actually have to lose if the bank is making poor decisions or any financial institution is making poor decisions rather than being able to win in both cases. So I certainly agree with you. It does seem incredible.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, this is indeed one of the things that I think has been proposed or at least has been discussed. That is that the people who are in the top management of big banks or big investment companies, if they make decisions and then that was proven to be wrong, disastrously wrong, that somehow they have to be held accountable. How do you do that? How do you establish that kind of accountability so that someone like that wouldn't make this disastrous decision and bring their their company to the brink of financial collapse and then just be able to walk away.
Well, losing their job is pretty significant incentive to not make improper decisions on that. And I don't think that we need to go out and punish people beyond the fact that they would lose their job. The thing that sort of sticks in our throat is that when they lose their job, they end up being able to take with them tens of millions of dollars of bonus payments when they've actually reduced the stock value by 10 or 20 or even 50% in some cases. I think that's where it seems to be a problem, is they seem to be rewarded for leaving the job rather than just terminated for cause, because they serve at the wishes of the board. If the board at any time wants to remove them, they can. But the buyouts just seem to be so high given the circumstances that were occurring.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that is at the discretion of the individual boards of directors of these companies?
Well, it is at the discretion of the boards, but it's part of their contract. When they're initially signed on with a company, and to attract somebody, you would give them certain incentives. But if all the incentives are you're rewarded as long as the risks pay off, but you're not don't suffer any significant financial consequences if the value of the stock tumbles as a result of some of your decisions, then it's encouraging people to make the wrong decisions. The board could structure compensation packages that are geared very effectively toward long-term profitability. For example, again, this is off the top of my head, not allowing people to benefit from short-term stock prices, but making any manager have to hold on to the stock for 5 to 10 years and then get any benefits that have occurred from that, and not just in total, but just in comparison with an industry peer or in comparison with industry totals. So you're only rewarded for long-term success of your decisions, not the short-term value.
Well, that certainly is something that has been suggested, and that for a variety of reasons, I think people feel that would be certainly a lot healthier for the business, not that is, and would then maybe lead the management to have to think more long-term, to think about the benefit of the company over the long-term rather than the short-term, if you can structure the way that they benefit so that it benefits them if they do better over the long term or the short. Is that the kind of thing that are people just talking about that, or are you actually starting to see that?
I have not seen it occur yet, but again, these boards have independent decisions in doing this, and they're a competitive market to get the top talent. So it would really take some leading financial institutions to say, this is how we're going to structure our package for the rest of the industry to start falling into place on there. It's not something that a small bank would be likely to be able to do, because they'll lose their talent to people who take jobs that are less risky for them because they're more assured of getting the payout on short-term gains.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk with someone in Whiteheath, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm just calling. I've been watching C-SPAN and Senate hearings on speculation, and excuse me. And there's a man named Michael Greenberger who is now a professor at the University of Maryland, and he was at one time in the 90s on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he believes that our whole financial system is in disarray and that it really needs regulation because no one. People are just like pirates. They're just doing whatever they want to do, and especially after the law that was passed, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which allowed investment bankers to be unregulated, and so they have what's called a shadow system where they make deals that aren't even on the books, that don't have any transparency, so that the public doesn't know what's going on. Nobody knows where any of the money is. They make bets on whether interest rates are going to go up or down, or whether mortgages are interest is going up or down, or all kinds of things. It's just like a betting house, and it's not transparent, so nobody knows what's going on with all this money that's going through this system. And people will make billions of dollars by making bets, just like on the commodities market where. Now, speculators aren't even regulated anymore on certain commodities like oil futures. And so he believes that if we don't start doing some regulation on some of this banking system, that this is our country's in really deep trouble. How do you feel about this? Have you heard of Michael Greenberger? And how do you feel about some of his points of view on this?
Well, I've heard of Michael Greenberger in the past, but I was not familiar with the current speculation or current presentation he's given on speculation. But I will relate that to what happened at Bear Stearns. I think the fact that the U.S. Treasury had to come up and guarantee $30 billion to J.P. Morgan that the deal will not sour means that the U.S. taxpayer is now at risk when investment banks lose money, so therefore they're going to have to be subject to additional regulation, more transparency since we're now doing it. So I think the fact that the Bear Stearns transaction took place as it did means that there will have to be more regulation in this particular area. And as you point out, and as Greenberger pointed out, this is something that's going to be necessary because we're suffering losses that the taxpayers are at risk for, and therefore there has to be some regulatory oversight to understand what those risks are and limit them and put some controls on them.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I mean, it's very complicated for me because I don't know that much about banking, but it seems like we should have been regulating the savings and loans better, and look what happened to them. There's all kinds of things that should be regulated better, and they're just sort of like, well, the bankers know their business. They will do what's right, and then we come to find out, no, they don't really. There's some in the business that don't do what's right, and then it ends up that the public has to carry their bag for them. So I hope they do install some new regulations on those businesses so that our economy is a little more safe and secure for regular folks. Thanks.
All right,
thank you.
The caller, so we'll go on in just a moment. I would, for anybody who just tuned in, would like to introduce again our guest for this first hour of Focus 580, Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the current crisis of America's financial system, what that has to do with the subprime mortgage mess, and what that's meant for credit and for the strength of a lot of the companies, the country's big banks and investment firms, either their strength or concerns about their weakness, and what that means for regulation. Now there are people in Congress and in the Treasury Department who are talking about making changes in the regulations, and we're trying to talk a little bit about what that would mean. Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to get back to a couple of these issues, but I have some other callers, so rather than make them wait, we'll go to the phones, and then I want to come back to talk more about regulation and speculation. But next, let's talk with someone in, this is Bloomington, Indiana, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned that the mortgage industry has become more restrictive in granting loans. We hear complaints that it's now really hard to get a loan, and our economy runs on credit. Is the mortgage industry now too restrictive, and is that restrictiveness threatening recession?
That's an excellent question, and I wish I had an exact answer for it, but let me give you my views on this. Much of the gains that our economy has had over the last 5 or 6 years has been fueled by rising real estate prices, under which a number of people would, in my mind foolishly, but they would refinance their homes, take out a larger mortgage, and use the proceeds for current spending to maintain their current lifestyle on that. So they were buying things, they were continuing, cars, they were buying appliances, they were buying vacations, they were doing things that would keep the economy going. Now that housing prices aren't rising but are in fact falling, that takes the home equity portion of our economy out of the picture. So you don't have individuals being able to refinance their home at a gain and have some additional disposable capital. I think that's one of the reasons we're having an economic stimulus check being sent to us now, is to try to get some money back in the economy to help replace some of this, because we are facing recession. If you would lose, or we are in danger of recession, losing a large amount of purchasing power from the home equity loan values that were occurring before. So that could be a contributor toward how the recession develops in this country, whether it does, how long it is on it. Housing prices are now declining. As a result, people that are willing to lend money for a mortgage are being much more restrictive. They're concerned about the borrower's ability to repay rather than knowing or thinking that the collateral would always be there to bail them out in case the homeowner would default on that. And that causes a cycle, because if somebody who could buy a home is no longer able to get financing, they won't, forcing housing prices down even further, forcing more foreclosures, taking additional purchasing power out of the economy, and creating additional recessionary pressures. So that is a problem, but it's a natural reaction. The investors who are willing to invest at a very low interest premium for a while in mortgages, thinking they were a very secure investment, have been burned. They realize they were wrong before, so now they're being more cautious and perhaps overly cautious, but only time will tell as to when we hit the bottom in housing prices and it turns around and it starts being a good investment again.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go on to the next caller. This is someone on cell phone and line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
2 years ago, I purchased a condo and had financing set up for a 30-year fixed loan. And 4 days before closing, the bank called and said, well, you're in a condo complex, and since it's not 80% sold, the only way you're going to get a loan is a 5-1 ARM. So I ended up in a 5-1 ARM. How it happened seemed very irregular to me. They should have let me know way before that, but it was like 4 days before closing. I don't know if that comes under regulation or not, but it's certainly something that should be looked at. And I understand that it protects the bank or the lender from maybe an unscrupulous developer that may go under and before the complex is completely sold. But here I am sitting with a 5-1 ARM, and I've got 3 years left on it, and the complex is still not 80% sold, and I'm going to have to do something within that 3 years. But my desire was a 30-year fixed loan, had the financing for it and everything, and was just completely, the door was shut on me. So I'm going to let you answer it offline, and thank you very much.
Okay. Can you say something about that?
Well, that's a problem with individuals trying to borrow money from a financial institution and really not having much bargaining power when the bank is changing the provisions of the loan shortly before the loan. You can only walk away or start shopping all over again, which is very time-consuming. So one of the reasons that we do have regulation in this area is to protect the buyers from unscrupulous lenders or unscrupulous mortgage originators, but perhaps in this case it didn't work effectively, or the choices were so limited on that. But that is a problem, and given the interest rate environment that we're in right now, having to reset a loan in a few years could be very, very expensive, but it all depends on how fast we work our way out of this particular problem.
All right. Well, let's go on to another caller, and this would be someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah. What are the parallels? It seems to me that it was with the savings and loan, crisis. The taxpayer got stuck on that one. Are there some parallels there? I mean, I from my understanding, that was because of deregulation and all that kind of stuff. Was that true, or?
Well, the savings and loan problems that developed in the 1980s were based on a business plan that involved investing in mortgages and holding long fixed-term rate mortgages, but relying on being able to raise capital by issuing bank accounts, certificates of deposit and bank accounts. But in the environment in the late 1970s, when money market funds were available, people didn't invest in the savings and loan and getting a 4 or 5 or even 5.5% rate of return. They went to the money market funds where they could get 7 or 8, in some cases double-digit returns. So the savings and loans ended up not being able to meet their business plan and suffering losses. And since they are insured by the federal government ended up paying significant sums of money in the hundreds of billions of dollars in order to bail out of that problem because of the financial guarantees associated with that. Are there similar parallels now? In order to try to avoid some disasters, the U.S. government now, through the Treasury and other sources, are providing capital to the markets to try to keep the markets going. Now, if the markets return quickly, then they will not suffer any losses. But if we're in a long-run downturn, then we'll lose money through the Bear Stearns buyout. We'll lose money through the guarantees that are going through the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Mac guarantee systems that have been putting additional capital into mortgages and trying to jumpstart the system or try to soften the landing associated with this. So the taxpayer is at risk. We don't know how much it's going to be. It'll take years to determine that. But the short answer to your question is yes, it's very similar to the 1980s. But the problem now is it's probably a more severe financial crisis than the 1980s, because in the 1980s it was limited to savings and loans and the mortgage market. Now it's spread much further than that into many commercial real estate areas, into the recession that we're occurring, the falling dollar, the rising prices on resources from food to gasoline to other sources that we'd have. So it seems to be a more serious problem that we're in right now than the 1970s, early 1980s.
Yeah, the final, not particular question, but was there something like, was it $700 and some trillion dollars that was floating around in terms of, capital? And the value of that went down about half, is that correct?
I'm not sure of that. I do know that on real estate values, we're seeing declines in the order of about 15% this year compared to last year, and given the amount of real estate capital that's available, that's a significant value. That's in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you this. One of the suggestions that has been made in terms of new regulations go something like this. We were saying to large investment banks, we're saying to them, if you want to make risky investments, this is up to you. However, we're going to require you to have enough solid capital so that if these risky investments go bad, you're not going to go out of business. You can absorb the loss because you're not so far overextended into the risky stuff that if that goes sour on you, you go belly up. Do you think that that's a good idea?
That's the amount of leverage that you're allowing investment banks or hedge funds or other agencies or other organizations such as insurance companies or banks to participate in. And investment banks do have a very, very high leverage ratio. If you're guaranteeing that you'll bail them out if problems occur, then you have to rein in the amount of risk they could take, and that would be to reduce the amount of leverage they would have, in essence, increasing their capital. Now, that sounds like it's a very innocuous change, is have less capital, but the repercussions that would have would be it may be harder to get loans because you no longer have the capital that's available to make the loans for homeowners, so homeowners have to pay it. So the concern that I would have about the Treasury's proposal for significant financial reform is, right now, if legislators were considering this, there'd be a tendency for them to do something that's popular, to blame somebody, to blame a particular type of institution, or to blame a particular practice, and to ban that, when that might not be sound practice in the long run, because if you significantly change the ability of a financial institution to issue credit, then you're going to dry up credit that is available for people to use to develop businesses, to take out home loans, to build new buildings, or to pay for the fertilizer they're doing for the crops that they want to grow for the year. Mm-hmm. So there are repercussions that have to be considered. These are not easy changes that you'd make. They're not easy solutions to come up with. And as a result, considering them in a crisis mode, because we are in a financial crisis right now, may not be the best thing to do, because if you're looking at a proposal for financial reform, there'll be a lot of suggestions that you do things that sound good and are popular but may have adverse repercussions in the long run. And we all know, what led to the Great Depression in the United States was some tariff acts that sounded good. They sounded very protectionist, but they ended up hurting us and the rest of the world for a long time.
Yeah. We know that there were a number of large financial institutions that were heavily invested in these collateralized debt obligations, these things that were the bundles of the subprime mortgages that went sour, and then those companies found themselves with very heavy losses. And it was very serious, and a lot of places laid off a lot of people. And there was one company in particular, Bear Stearns, a big company that had been around for a long time, that was on the brink of going out of business. And had it not been for somebody else coming along, J.P. Morgan Chase come along and said, well, we'll loan you some money. And then what happened was that J.P. Morgan Chase ended up taking over Bear Stearns. So essentially there is no more Bear Stearns. And that this deal was considered to be so important that apparently people in Washington felt it was so important that Bear Stearns was salvaged, that the Federal Reserve came in and said to J.P. Morgan Chase, essentially, well, we'll back you on this. Do you think a good idea? Was it important that that happened?
That's a hard call to make as to whether it was the right decision or not. Bear Stearns ran into difficulty when its counterparties, people who would be participating in trades with them, refused to continue trading with them because they were concerned about their financial viability. So if you're an investment bank and people are unwilling to trade with you, you're out of business. Mm. And they're going to demand you pay up collateral, you cash out collateral, and you simply can't function. So you basically have to be a strong financial institution to be in this business, and as soon as people suspect you're not in a strong financial position, whether you are or not, if they suspect that you have a problem, it's like a run on the bank. These aren't protected by the FDIC, so therefore people would take pulling capital out and refusing to invest in those. Now, if Bear Stearns had gone under, they would have learned a lesson. The entire financial markets would have learned a lesson. Don't get overexposed in this particular area. Look at the consequences that would have. But if that occurred, then there would have been a lot of defaults on the positions that it had outstanding, and those would have hurt many other institutions, some very sophisticated financial institutions and some less sophisticated financial institutions. Pension funds, for example, that are representing benefits that the average worker would get would have gotten hurt on that as well. Plus, the psychological effect of having a major financial institution collapse would have drained the confidence in the country. And again, much of the economy hums along because people think that it's doing well. If people start suspecting there are serious problems, they tend to be self-perpetuating because you're less likely to make an investment, you hold on to your cash more, you get require higher credit ratings, and things start to slow down. So I believe it's impossible to say whether it's the right decision or not now. It may be something historians can figure out at some time in the future. But by moving into this particular area, the Treasury has essentially issued a guarantee to anyone that it doesn't make any difference if you're dealing with a less than stellar credit worthy counterparty as an investment bank, because if they go sour, we'll step in. And that's bad because it takes away the discipline that the market would have to keep an investment bank or another financial institution to be well capitalized, because then it would not be able to continue to trade.
Yeah. Well, it seems that here that there's a very difficult to know where that line is between saying on the one hand that institutions, they're taking risk, and that if they take too much risk, they do something ill-advised, and then they fail, they lose money, then you're saying, well, then that should be a lesson to other institutions, don't do that, and someone has to suffer for making bad decisions. But then there has to be some point where you say it's not just the people at that institution that are going to suffer. If the shock waves go out further into the economy, there's at some point where you have to say, well, that's too much, and we're going to step in and make sure that we put a break in there somewhere to try to limit the amount of damage in the economy as a whole.
Yes. And it's a matter of if they thought this were going to have adverse repercussions throughout the entire economy, then dealing with them after the fact would have been much more costly than dealing with them early. So the judgment call was to try to step in and make the problem smaller than it would otherwise be and try to keep the economy humming along. The fact that the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, and the administration are making such dramatic changes at this point, which really are proposing changes that are as dramatic as anything that have happened since the Great Depression, show just how concerned our top policymakers are as to how serious this could be, that if we did get into recession, that could be extremely long and extremely serious, and therefore they're trying to do lots of things, innovative things, to try to avoid that from happening and to keep us going on that. And it's a difficult choice. It's very easy to sit back and Monday morning quarterback, but they've got to make some very difficult decisions with very short lead time in situations that they've never faced before, and they're doing their best.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a question and a comment.
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to know, are homes under foreclosure a good investment to buy right now and hope that the value goes up on them? And my comment was that my husband and I bought a timeshare, and it's turned out to be like the worst investment ever. And what's your views on timeshares? I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Okay. Is that something you feel you can talk about?
Well, it's not my area of expertise, but I think I know enough to say that timeshares are not a very good idea in most cases. I've read enough from financial advisors that indicate these can be much more likely to be problems than to work out to be a good idea. So you have to research them very carefully before making the decisions, because there are lots of people who have lost them. Now, the question that you asked earlier about would buying a foreclosed home be a good investment is going to the answer would be it depends. And it doesn't make a difference whether it's in foreclosure or just buying a home that is trying to be sold by the owner at this current point. If you are looking at buying a home for flipping it, getting in and then fixing it up a little bit and then selling it, it may not be a good investment to do, because housing prices may continue to stagnate or even decline further in the future, so you may end up losing money on that. If you're looking at buying a home now because you want to be in the home for 10 to 20 years, then whether or not it goes down another 5 or 10% really doesn't make too much difference for you, because you get into a home you want to be in, you're living in it, you're making payments to building up home equity, assuming that you're not taking out something like an interest-only loan, but you're actually building up equity. And housing in the long run has proved to be an excellent investment for individuals because it's forced savings. You have to make a monthly mortgage payment each month, and therefore you do that, and the money doesn't get frittered away on luxuries or things you don't have later. So getting into a home at the right time, you should not would be a good thing to do. Trying to make sure that you get a reasonable price, make sure you get good advice about the value of what you should offer for a particular home. But I don't think whether it's in foreclosure or just being sold by the current owner would make a significant difference to that. It's just what you plan to do with the home when you move into it.
All right. Let's go to Champagne, line two. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
It's current fiasco strikes me as parallel to like the savings and loan swindle that went on a few years ago, in that these people make a ton of money, then they like dodge their risk by letting the federal government bail them out. Here we go again with Bear Stearns, which the federal government is really guaranteeing that the money that the other bank put in to rescue Bear Stearns. It's sort of the variation also on the concept of when you owe the bank $100,000, you got a problem. When you owe them $100 million, the bank's got a problem. I mean, this is a swindle. Once again, like these people, you say they're doing the best they can. They've all done very well for themselves, you know, and now here we are, like we're supposed to, like, pick up the bill. What do you think?
Excuse me. I was saying that the government is trying to do the best they can. I wasn't commenting necessarily on Bear Stearns or Citicorp or any other financial institutions that suffered some significant losses. Well, I'm not so sure they've done the best they can. I was commenting on regulators.
Is the government doing the best they can for the people, or are they doing the best they can for the institutions?
The steps they're making at this point seem to be they're doing the best they can for the economy in general, which is going to help everyone. Of course it will help the people who are directly involved significantly, but the steps are being made to try to limit the damage to the entire economy. So I believe the steps are being taken to try to help everyone, although some of the beneficiaries would be the individuals who made some of the faulty decisions to start off with.
Can I just make one last comment?
Yeah, please do.
I think that analysis is like naive or faulty, or this is boom bust capitalism. It's one of their traits, and I just think they're taking us for a ride again. But thank you.
Right. That is a risk that if you are rewarding the insiders or rewarding people who make significant political contributions, which unfortunately seem to be a tendency in our system at the state as well as the national level, then you do have problems associated with that. And many of the decisions that are made do seem to benefit people who are favored, and that is a problem for all of us and something that we need to keep in mind as we continue to go to the polls.
One thing I want to make sure that I get in here and ask you, there has been a proposal made by the Treasury Department to do a major kind of reorganization of regulatory responsibility and, in fact, create a whole new agency to take some of the responsibility from the controller of the currency, the Fed, the FDIC, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the National Credit Union Administration, and to take some of the responsibility from all of these agencies and to create something brand new. This would be called the Prudential Financial Regulatory Agency. Do you think that that is a good idea?
Well, it's ironic that the Treasury Department started looking at how to reform our financial system well before the current crisis, and the idea was to loosen up regulations that are cumbersome, overlapping, patchwork, mm-hmm. in order to allow our financial system to meet the international competition that it needs to face, in which they are more advanced. But as things unfolded, the proposal came out just as the time we were in the midst of the crisis, and the general idea is to let's make financial institutions freer and able to make more decisions on their own at a time when it seems to be evident that that's not a good decision to make, because given too much leeway, they seem to be getting in problems that then the U.S. Treasury has to step in and bail them out on that. So it would be a good idea if you can do it in the long run, but if you try to make that determination over the next couple of years, it's going to be awfully difficult to focus on positive changes in the regulatory system and avoid the negative ones.
Well, it seems probably unlikely that the Congress is – I'm sure they have their own ideas, and we're going to have another – we don't know who, but we're going to have another president, and it seems – does it seem likely that anything really dramatic is going to happen now within the – between now and the end of the year?
Only a lot of speeches to make it look like they're doing something to fix the problem, to perhaps build our confidence back up, or perhaps for us to vote for them to be reelected so they can deal with the problem sometime later. But I don't see any short-term solutions.
Real quick here, we'll try to get in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Speaking of short-term solutions, have you heard anything about the effects of the stimulus package? I mean, I know it's only been about a month since the checks went out, but did it really make a difference?
I haven't seen anything on that, but it can't hurt because people are going to be spending some of this money.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you. It's an interesting question because I think when this happened before, the thought was that people would go out and spend the money, and mostly what people did was they prudently put it in the bank or they used it to reduce debt. And this time around, when reporters went around asking people what they were going to do, people sort of said the same thing. They said, well, maybe we'll save it and maybe we'll use it to pay off our credit cards. Now, what people actually do, that's something else. So is your feeling, well, you would not want to make some prediction about how this would go. You would just say, well, we don't really know, and maybe in a couple of months I could tell you, but right now I can't say.
Well, it will be helpful in some way, and mm-hmm. even if people are saving the money, that will be helping their own financial situation, which is beneficial in the long run for us as well.
Well, there are some other things that I thought maybe we might try to get into, but we are here at the end of the time, and I think probably we're just going to have to stop there for now, with the promise I'm sure that some of these issues we'll get back to on other days. But we want to say thanks to our guest, Stephen Darcy. He's professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed this.